Good morning, Representative Bradley. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've got a lot of ground to cover, so I'll get right down to business. I'd like to move House File 2934 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Bradley moves House File 2934 for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Representative Bradley, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Perhaps this is something that a lot of you know that I've tried to work on in various ways. I think there are so many road bumps in our current menagerie of health programs with Minnesota Care, medical assistance with state-only funded, MCHA, and so forth, that there are breaks in continuity that don't make sense from a system point of view and oftentimes don't make sense even from a consumer point of view. So this time around, what I suggested was simply to ask the Department of Human Services to present to the legislature by January 15th of next year an implementation plan and draft legislation to provide integration. And there's nothing that magic necessarily about the date. I think the wording was to try to at least give kind of a framework of what all that should include, because I think it needs to think comprehensively about not only how you integrate the program, but in cases where you have people who are in and then maybe would be off to something else, for example, disabled and elderly, that there'd be provisions for that. I thought it was relatively straightforward, Mr. Chair and members, and then I got the fiscal note. And I was thinking, since I'm retiring this year, that maybe I could offer to do it for a lot less. The fiscal note says $720,000, and I have to admit, I was forewarned, but I was a bit amazed at the size and that there would be 50 headcounts, six actual FTEs that would be involved in this. We may need, as this sort of sits in our committee, to have some discussions. But I would hope, from the policy point of view, and then obviously the money will take care of itself from what we can afford, but that members will support the idea that it does make sense to look at how we could make our whole sets of public assistance health care programs more sensible from a systems management point of view and even from a consumer point of view. Appreciate support.
Members, any questions for Representative Bradley? Seeing no questions, does anybody wish to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no volunteers, the chair will lay over House File 2934 for possible inclusion.
Finstead, welcome to the committee. We'd like to move your bill, and then I think you may have an amendment and maybe a little discussion about amendment even.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 3591 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill.
Finstead moves House File 3591 be considered for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make a plea to you and to the committee. I have in your packets, members, there is a DE1 delete all amendment. And that amendment is the result of a lot of work in a short amount of time. And I will point out the time, let's see here, the time on the top. Just right here.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. What if you have the right amendment? We're dealing with one that does have a date of yesterday at 11:20. I thought you had something more recent than that.
Mr. Chair, that's what my recent pause was just about. I just realized that. Thank you.
The members have an amendment. I don't think members have it at this point. Do we have copies of that amendment?
We have the D.
I don't know.
It's a great amendment, Mr. Chair.
I trust you, but let's have an honorable process here.
Okay.
Do members now have it? Is actually the DE2 amendment? All members have the DE2 amendment? Well, let's put the motion on the table. Representative Finstead moves the H3591 DE2 amendment. Representative Finstead, to your amendment.
Yeah,
go ahead and explain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a delete all amendment to put the bill in the shape that all the groups that have, all the folks that have been working on this bill very hard, almost 24 hours a day for the last week, have been working on. And you'll notice the time on the top is stamped at 9:21 a.m., so I do apologize, the 24-hour rule. And I would leave it up to the committee and to the chair. I'm leaving it up to the chair to decide if you would take this amendment. But this is an amendment that will save us committee time because people will agree and support this bill now instead of hours of opposition. And again, it's just the product of the folks, both from my district and throughout the state, working together to try to come up with a compromise. So that's the quick.
Members of the committee, I think a lot of us have been involved in occasions when a bill being scheduled causes things to happen. I'm sympathetic. Is there any objection from anyone in the committee from hearing this amendment? No objections? And this would get the bill then in the form that you would be discussing this morning.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We're voting on the DE2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
I don't have a gavel.
Oh. Representative Finstead, do your amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief in respect of committee time, but how this bill came about was through the gentleman to my left here, Commissioner Andy Lochner from Brown County, who is a member of the South Country Healthcare Alliance. And the folks there have been working hard for, I believe, 4 years now on ways to work together and not essentially reinvent the wheel in the counties in the southern part of the state. They're working together to not only help consumers but also to save money and to be a great example of, I think, what we can do if we all put our heads together. I think what I'm going to do is turn it over. I have a list of testifiers, Mr. Chair. I'll turn it over to Commissioner Lochner, and then we'll go through the list, and a few of my testifiers will go through section by section to dissect the bill.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please begin by reintroducing yourself.
Good morning, everyone. I just got a few bullets I would like to present.
Commissioner, but if you begin by introducing yourself for our record.
Commissioner Andrew Lochner, Brown County.
Thank you.
And a member of South Country Health Association Board.
Welcome.
Today,
welcome.
The Crusades Mendo pilot projects have been successful and popular with their consumers, I should say. These special needs plans will include main features of the Mendo program. The county-based purchasing SNP create locally-based integrated coverage. Consumers can receive all the health care and social services from a single source, and the service can be well coordinated. Providers in this program will bill once and be paid for all services provided. County-based purchasing SNP offers greater flexibility than traditional medical assistance fee-for-service programs. Consumers receive personalized care coordination, help, and can receive some types of equipment and services that are not covered under medical assistance programs. County-based purchasing SNP can result in fewer emergency room visits and hospitalizations. Fewer health care resources in rural areas require an individualized local care coordination approach to assist consumers in finding and assessing appropriate care in a timely manner. county-based purchasing improves access to care and effectiveness of care through community-based coordination of local health and social service around the individual's needs. Prime West and South Country have been highly successful in serving PMAP participants and cost-effectively managing the medical assistance resource for the state at the local level. This program caps the state's financial liability under the medical assistance program for the services included. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We had the next, Tom Henderson. I'm sorry, Lieutenant Finn said, who do you wish to have? It's up to you, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Marion Brandt, please.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please also
good introduce. Morning, everyone. My name is Marion Brandt, and I'm the Executive Director of South Country Health Alliance, a county-based purchasing program that serves individuals in southern Minnesota and Kanabec County. We have been in operations for about since 2001. This year, we began serving persons with disabilities through our Medicare product that allowed us to have a local plan option for persons with disabilities to select for their Part D plan. We have about 500 members that have been enrolled in our program, and what this bill does is we are requesting that we receive a portion of the Medicaid services to also serve this disabled population. This will result in simplicity for consumers because they won't have to track two different payers. It will allow providers to bill only once. One of the things that South Country has been doing over these past few years is integrated care at the local level. We feel like we know how to do that, and so what we're asking here is to be allowed to serve persons with disabilities on a voluntary basis. This will give us critical experience as we move forward in 2008 with some of the additional reforms that are being planned and that this committee will be dealing with around the mental health legislation. These are important steps, and it's more important, it's important for the consumers we serve. These folks are vulnerable living in our community, and our goal is to make sure that they continue to live there. We only get part of the way where we want to be with this legislation. You will find that waiver services, continuing care services, are not a part of the benefits that we're seeking at this point in time. We aren't going to have all of the flexibility we'd like to have at this point, but we're committed to bringing in the Medicaid wraparound services with the goal of ultimately integrating all services for this population. And I will be available for any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have Ann Henry here to go over the bill.
Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center, part of the Legal Aid Society. I actually don't have a copy. The amendment, as Representative Finn said was worked on by a number of parties, and there are some different sections. So we'll start with Section 1. This has to do with data that health plans report to the commissioner when they provide health care through managed care for medical assistance recipients, and actually for other programs as well. We have had some problems in the past getting access to information, and now that people with disabilities are going to be participating in managed care, we want to be sure that we have access to the same data at the department that we have now in the fee-for-service system. So we have worked with the department. We also had a large meeting about 2 weeks ago with the health plans that the department called together to look at this, but I understand that the health plans still have some concerns about this, and we're certainly willing to keep talking and see what can be worked out. But the language here would provide that non-personally identifiable information on encounter data, such as going to the doctor, getting rehab services, and so on, is public information that would, it's reported to the commissioner now, and so we're just not making any new reporting requirements, but we want to be sure that we can get that data from the commissioner. The second part of the data that is clarified here is the total amount paid by service that the department now reports in their forecast for fee-for-service. And so we would like to be able to track again where the money's going that we're paying for health care for people on the program. And then finally, criteria for authorization that's required in the utilization review law and in the Code of Federal Regulations. The second section involves the Minnesota Disability Health Option Program, and this clarifies that the program's now expanding can continue, but that further expansion will wait until January of 2008. In the meantime, we will have discussions about a number of issues, including home and community services and what happens with those services as we move to managed care. And a report or a discussion will come back to you next February. Section 3 is really the biggest change in the bill, we think, which is allowing people with disabilities in medical assistance to enroll in managed care. And the focus here for the first phase of this is on plans that are already providing managed care for Medicare benefits. So you've heard about all the problems with Part D and medication for low, especially low-income people. This would allow plans providing Medicare, including Part D, to also bring people's medical assistance, they're going to the doctor, hospital, therapy services, into the same plan and integrate it together. And we think that that will be a benefit for people if properly structured, and that's why we do have a stakeholder group. Also, an important point to make here is that this is voluntary. We think we get a lot of quality and a lot of good practice when we have voluntary enrollment. So people would be able to decide to go into these plans because they met their needs. The plans would be motivated to do a good job because they want to keep their enrollees. That's very valuable. Section 4 changes topic a bit. It's still on Medicaid, medical assistance, but it recognizes that major changes were made in the Federal Deficit Reduction Act of 05 and sets up a stakeholder process so that people can be involved in discussions about changes the department may be proposing next year for premiums, co-payments, benefit sets, home and community waiver. There are many, many changes possible, and we'd like to be at the table. Section 5 clarifies that there would be legislative authorization for changes made under the Deficit Reduction Act. Now, I have just been in conversation with department staff and understand that that may be drawn a bit too broadly, and so we would also agree to work with them and try to define that a little better. But the major reason for that section is because a lot of people are concerned that big changes, sweeping changes in Medicaid could happen without coming to the legislature. While I don't think the department would do that, this just makes it clear that the legislature will make those decisions. And then Section 6 adds $200,000 to the Ombudsman's Office for Managed Care, recognizing that a new population will need those ombudsman services as they move into the managed care, combining Medicaid and medical assistance. And that completes the description of the amendment. Thank you.
Ms. Henry, if I may, on the Section 1, the first page, the data area. First of all, I suspect, Representative Finn said that might require civil law review. Just looking at the language, I wouldn't be surprised, it probably would. So that's one thought. The other question is sort of, it seems kind of almost out of place. I heard your words, but I'm wondering just how critical this is. I think this raises some issues, and we're probably going to hear them a little later. But you're into an area here that probably creates controversy, whereas you've got others together. How critical is this to the rest of the parts that you're trying to accomplish?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the importance of this, this really grows out of our desire to be able to trace and have accountability for moving people into managed care. If you look at the data now, we know actually a lot because of how reports are done in the fee-for-service system. And we just want to clarify this information. For instance, in terms of Section 1, the encounter data, the department now says they don't regard that as a trade secret. And, in fact, they have now given us information on, for instance, personal care assistance spending by age group, by health plan. We had had trouble getting that in the past, but I don't think it perhaps is quite as controversial as maybe some people might think. It may be that the spending is more controversial, and we think that we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars of public money for people on these programs, and we ought to at least know in large categories what the money's spent on. And again, we have that information now for people with disabilities and actually for the whole fee-for-service population, and we would like to be able to track that as we move into managed care. That's the reason I think it's very connected to moving people with disabilities into managed care.
Okay. Well, my bringing up, our backs are against the wall on committee deadlines here, and I worry a little bit, I'm not sure I'm absolutely right, but there's a high probability that this goes to civil law, and I've seen some of the civil law schedules. Squeezing another one in could be problematic. I guess that'll be up to you, but I don't know if that we'll try to find out before here, but I wouldn't be surprised that we might have to change the motion here to have it because of this section go to civil law.
Mr. Chair, on that topic, I specifically tried not to have that happen by not changing the Data Practices Act at all. All we have here is how data is treated under contract by the department. So we're not changing how trade secrets are treated in terms of the Data Practices Act at all. We're just clarifying that the commissioner already has authority, but it's only in contract. And so we're bringing this up to make it more clear that this data is something people can have access to.
Ms. Hunter, I'm not at all trying to do damage to the bill, but having just had a bill called there that all it did was fund some electronic medical record potential projects, I don't think that the data practices area is the only issues that they review. I'm sorry. Any other questions from members on the content of the bill? Mr. Huntman? The testifier probably too, so.
And either Ms. Henry or maybe people from the county, who does the case management currently for these people? And who will do it in the future? And are any of those dollars that you are getting now for case management part of what's being cut by the feds?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, in this bill we envision that the individuals doing case management currently would continue to do case management. Because that case management is funded under the waivered services, we're not contemplating any change at this point. I would have to respectfully defer to the folks from DHS with regard to whether or not these case management dollars are vulnerable to the federal cuts. If it's targeted case management, I assume that it is, but I think there are people here who can speak to that issue better than I can. But I think I want to be clear to folks that at this point we are not asking to bring in case management into the capitation. We're leaving that as it is at this point in time. So our members will continue to have their case manager from the county.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion at this point, is there anyone else that wishes to testify regarding this bill? Morning, welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tom Henderson, Director of Brown County Family Services, which is one of the nine counties that's in South Country Health Alliance. I would like to speak from the standpoint that we see as counties that managed care is the future for disabled, and in South Country we've been working with the non-disabled for the last 4 years and helping them come into a managed care environment, and we found it to be very amicable for the client themselves to have a local delivery system, so to speak, someone they can talk to in the county, and that they don't see a lot of change happening with South Country. under the disabled, we think it's even more important, and that that's what this will do, that they keep their same vendors in place, that the case management not change, that the faces of their services don't change. And what this is going to allow us to do is bring medical together with the social services part, the community part. We spend a lot of our time with the disabled as case managers locally, just helping people with the basics of life, where to live, how to get the next meal. It's very basic what we deal with people on every day. Now we want to include the medical piece to under medical assistance. We already got Medicare. Now we would have Medicaid, medical also. Aside from the amendment that you've heard about, that's what this bill does. And it's not that complicated. And we think we will precede any other efforts this state makes to capitate medical assistance for the disabled. And we'll do it at a local level and bring people together to do it. We found Ability Care for the disabled to be a very popular program in its first 2 months of existence. 500 people have signed up for it in 9 rural counties overnight, so to speak. They are gravitating to it quickly. Why? Because it becomes a one-stop shop for them. Medicaid, in future, Medicare, Part A, B, and D, and it includes their local services to boot. So it's a win-win for clientele on a local level.
Thank you. Is there anyone else? I think I just see some additional people that wish to testify. Please come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Vicki Kuhner from the Department of Human Services, and I just have a brief remark about Section 1. In the first line, the new underlying phrase, in the contract with the commissioner, this may have been for clarification, but what it does is actually block the commissioner's authority to get information from the health plans beyond what would be specified in the contract. So we would hopefully eliminate that phrase, but I think it's because the commissioner has authority to require information both within the contract and outside, and that would appear to block.
Ms. Kuhner, what line are you referring to?
Line 1.6 on the first page of the amendment, DE2. For the rest of the segment, Section 1, Part B, Number 1 and 3 are already currently in operation and possible. 2 is the only new language, and there may be other comments about that. But 1 and 3, that's already in place in federal requirements and in our contract. Thank you.
Someone from the department may need later. We haven't discussed yet the fiscal note. We'll come back to that. There were additional testifiers. I think I saw somebody else that wished to testify.
My name is Jim Prisabilla. I'm the CEO of Prime West Health System. We are the county-based purchasing organization for 10 counties in west central and southwestern Minnesota. This bill is a good, important step forward to integrating resources and removing those silos we've talked about so often. There are things that we should be concerned about in this bill in terms of the information that wishes to be gathered in order to track accountability. I think there's probably some compromise, and we look forward to working with the advocates in finding those. My biggest concern in that particular area is I rely on other vendors to help me with that information, and that how they gather that is their trade secret. And I could have vendors fleeing from me right and left if they find out that the things that they develop in their private sector business is subject to public law or public open to public viewing. So I'm a concern about that part. But the rest of the bill and what it's trying to achieve and its ability to integrate the multiple resources to care for a vulnerable population that we speak is incredible. Currently, Prime West already serves 50% of its disabled population. So this is not a new population for us, but we do on a daily basis in our rural area find the frustration with the lack of our ability to integrate the resource to bring to bear the scarce resources we have spread across the large geographic region to benefit the individual disabled person. So anything that moves forward, like this bill, toward integration for the vulnerable populations that we serve and allows our ability true work with providers and the consumer together is something that we very much support, and we'll work with advocates and all involved to try to make this happen very shortly. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there, we've had a fair amount of proponent testimony, and maybe, well, maybe just ask the question, is there anybody that has concerns or would wish to testify in opposition to this bill? Or just provide information? Okay. I don't see anybody. Whoops, I'm sorry. Really, I thought you were going to come up, but I didn't see you weren't moving.
She was waiting for
me. There's only, she was getting about 3 seconds and...
Mr. Chairman, to the committee, Representative Finn said, my name is Julie Bruner. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Health Funds. I'm here this morning not in opposition to the bill, but we do oppose Section 1 for reasons which you probably have heard already. I understand that there may be an author's amendment. I don't want to take any of your time for my testimony if there's going to be an author's amendment. So...
Mr. Chair?
Instead, you want to shorten the discussion a little bit?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make a statement before I make the motion, but my statement is simply this, that this is an important issue to the groups that brought this bill forward, and I would ask the plans, the department, whoever else may have concerns to continue to work with us so we can all get on the same page with some of the concerns in Section 1. So that's my plea and my my wish. But with that being said, with deadlines and with all the great testimony on the rest of the bill, I will move then to delete Section 1 of the DEQ amendment.
Instead moves to amend House File 3591 as amended by striking Section 1. Any further discussion for that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, if I may just say, for the record, we're committed, and I give you my word, that we will work with Ms. Henry and the department over the interim to see if we can't narrow the scope of this to make sure that the information and the accountability that I think is behind the section prevails. And so you have my word next.
Good. I'm glad to have that on the record. So I think that there is fruit in this section, and I hope that we would proceed. Any further discussion among members? Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm just struck by how similar this is to the governor's proposal for how we're going to treat mentally ill in the future. His bill is not here yet, but it's very similar. You can argue back and forth over the case management part of that bill, but this is the mentally ill are another population that we certainly need to better integration of their health care and living circumstances.
Good. Well, there being no further discussion, the chair will hold over House File 3591 as amended for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bradley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move on, though, I failed to come back to and to the author. We didn't talk about the fiscal note,
right.
And let's just say it's pretty big. So I would appreciate some discussion with me about along the way. I mean, it's laying there. I didn't get a chance to review all of it, but we didn't discuss it. I'll just acknowledge that.
Duly noted, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 3557 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Representative Bradley moves House File 3557 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Human Service omnibus bill. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, and our testifier, I think, can give the background more than I, but it has been brought to my attention that there have been As a result of probably some legitimate concerns, I think we need a little...
Excuse me, Mr. Representative Bradley. Representative Abler, could you quiet everyone down up there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bradley.
Members may recall that there were brought to the public some occasions of abuse in personal care attendants where there might have been some multiple buildings and so forth, and I'm not going to review all that, but I think that's sort of the heart of what was being trying to be accomplished here, is to bring some better accountability. Sometimes, however, the solution can take on an air that's almost worse than the problem. I don't know, I'm not trying to pass judgment that's where we are, but certainly as this has begun to unfold and we've begun to see consequences on certain settings of personal care attendants in housing settings and so forth, there have been, I think, consequences at least were unintended from my personal point of view. What the bill does is simply delay implementation. I don't want to spend too much time on it. The consequence of delay in implementation appears to be over $3 million in this biennium, so we do have fiscal note issues. But I would like first to get before the committee an opportunity to hear some of the concerns. So if we could proceed with testimony from Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Bradley. Mr. Nelson, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Bradley, for moving this issue forward. I am Bruce Nelson, the Executive Director of ARM. Joining me today, and we will try to be brief. It is a very complex issue, but joining me will be John Nelson from Residential Services of Northeast Minnesota and substitution Linda Adams from Accessible Space. Representative Bradley is correct. In an attempt to attack double billing by PCAs and some fraud that apparently is going on out there, the department now is in the process of enrolling each and every PCA across the state of Minnesota and giving him or her an identification number. And when a provider then does billing, we'll attach the number of that individual to the clients that they serve. The bill addresses the impact on services that utilize PCAs in pooled or shared settings. And we can maybe get to that, and John Nelson can describe that better. But I'll give you a quick example. In a waiver home, like a caddy home, you may have two people who are served as caddy residents and two as PCA clients. And then you have the PCA, therefore, serving multiple clients. And we get back to that when you're trying to bill PCA per PCA client on quarter-hour increments, if using pooled and shared hours, that person is serving multiple people at various times through the day, you've set up an almost impossible situation to track by the quarter hour and then therefore do the billing. Now, I should tell you, members of the committee, that this model I'm describing is the principal model we're now using to serve people with mental illness, to get those folks out of institutions, out of nursing homes. And we've done a quick survey that shows minimally about 400 people would be affected. Wow. Now, what is the impact on this model that we're now using to get people out of institutions? As I mentioned, it maybe is impossible to track the number of hours first in the group home, and there are other settings you'll hear about, and then in the billing, and to break that down into quarter hour segments per PCA per client. The administrative cost, and we've tried to do some estimates, we know just on the billing side, if it were possible, and the model that might work, it was five times an increase just on the billing side, not even looking at the group home. The folks who are doing this model, they're putting together various funding streams, GRH dollars, difficulty of care dollars, PCA dollars, and putting those together in a way that they barely in many instances, aren't making it. You know, some are just above the margin, some are just below the margin. The impact is, with the added administrative cost, you're going to basically, if we move forward without figuring this out, we're going to kill the model. Providers simply can't sustain that expense and keep going. Now, the Department of Human Services, and I trust you'll be hearing from them later about fiscal note and other matters, worked with our members and other providers across the state in setting up the model. And they, in conversations with them, do agree that the administrative cost is so burdensome that it would, in fact, kill the model. Now, you're going to hear about a new issue if you hear from the department, and I trust you will, beyond the double billing issue. And that is that on further review, the department has determined that CMS rule or law does require, in the Medicaid law, require this kind of reporting of per PCA client. And the department, in conversations with us, fears an audit, and if there is an audit, possible payback that the state would be subject to. Now, we have been working with two groups in the department, the mental health people and the billing and medical assistance people, and been exploring ways. How can we sustain these services if not through this model, through by moving dollars around in a budget-neutral way to sustain that? The bill before you would delay the process or the implementation of this until July 1st, 2007, and it would require us to work together. Now, given the new information, if it's true of CMS regulation, we really do need to crank this up, members of the committee, and figure out a solution if there needs to be a legislative response to this by the end of this session. And you have my commitment from ARM to work night and day with DHS or with whomever to figure this out so that those 400, and I'm sure there are more than 400 people, won't lose their services and have to revert back, very likely, to nursing homes and the state institutions, which would also have a fiscal impact. So with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, unless we have questions for me, I'll turn it over to John Nelson from Residential Services in Northeast Minnesota.
Members, any questions? See no questions. Thank you. Mr. John Nelson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Nelson. I'm the Executive Director of Residential Services of Northeastern Minnesota, more commonly known as RSI. I guess also just for the record, we currently are serving about 61 people with mental illness in 20 different foster care settings in 9 different counties, using PCA as the primary funding source. And I'd like to just give a little background so that the members of the committee and Mr. Chair, that you can understand how this came about. In the late 90s, as DHS was trying to find places to move the last few clients at Moose Lake Regional Treatment Center, we became involved in looking at how folks with mental illness could find funding, because they were falling through the cracks, have been, and still continue to fall through the cracks. And our effort to do that resulted in us looking at the adult foster care model, using group residential housing and difficulty of care on the foster care side, and then using the PCA services on the staffing side. In order to make that work, we needed to look at pooling PCA as well as sharing the PCA. Pooling just means accumulating the number of hours together between the group of clients living together, and adding them up and providing that number of hours of staffing. Sharing means that you've got one client or one staff person working with multiple clients, two or three, and billing all three for that same hour. In our particular settings, of our current 61 clients, I think all but 9 share PCA as well as the pooling. When we first developed that model back in the late 90s, we knew then that it wasn't the best option, just like we know now it's not the best option, but it was then and still is the only option for keeping people out of the state hospital. The vast majority of the people we're serving came from Moose Lake, Brainerd, and Anoka State Hospitals, as well as Aquaching Nursing Home, the state nursing home. And I can also say that the department did take a look at it. The mental health division looked at the success in terms of quality of life and cost of care following six clients that moved from Brainerd for 1 year and comparing those costs with the cost that they would have had in the state hospital. Six clients, 1 year, over $500,000 in savings, about half of that coming from the federal participation dollars. So the model works despite the problems that you've heard about. And my concern is what happens with the model now if the documentation requirements go forward. And not only does it hurt the model I've described, but as the success has occurred, it's resulted in it being expanded. A number of other counties, a number of other providers are doing it. And not only doing it in foster care, but they're looking at other ways of using PCA as waiver funds are short. And so you have providers who are providing 24-hour a day, 7 days a week supports in a home for children. This is in Red Wing, Minnesota. And it's a lot like respite, except for the children don't have waivers. And so what do? They use the PCA dollars. They share them and are able to then get the staffing supports they need to have them there, whether it's for a few hours or for a few days. And so it's not just the foster care model we're talking about anymore. And you should also know that in a lot of homes, they're mixed with folks with the waivers. You might have one or two clients on a waiver and one or two clients on PCA in the same home. And again, the documentation requirements really add up to an almost impossible task, if not impossible task. I also want to say and repeat what Bruce said. I recognize that there's issues with CMS. I recognize there's issues with fraud. We've tried to work with the department in ways of identifying where fraud could happen and how to catch it. And I'm also prepared and have been trying to work with the department on what we can do to meet the CMS standards. And I realize that this model may just not meet those standards, and we need to make some significant changes. My request is that we don't kill the model first and then have no place to serve these people, because in terms of a fiscal note, take a look at how much cost will incur if the folks aren't living in the community and have to go back to where they came from. Consider the Olmstead Act and how the state is complying with that, and with all of the plans for downsizing the state institutions or closing them. A lot of that relies on this model at this point. And with that, I will end my remarks and ask if there's any questions.
Any questions from the members? See no questions. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Next on our list is not who I have on my list. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Linda Adams. I'm the contract administrator for Accessible Space Incorporated. We are one of the providers that's affected by these rule changes. ASI has provided personal care services using a pooled hour model since 1980 with the department's knowledge and approval. We currently provide personal care services to 152 people with physical disabilities, mobility impairments, and traumatic brain injury. The majority of them live in their own apartments and have access to staff 24 hours a day because of the option to pool their services. The individuals who choose us, it's a total voluntary thing, and they've chosen us because they like the security and flexibility that staff around the clock provides. This service option was first described in policy in April of 1999 and appeared in the Minnesota Healthcare Program Manual as recently as the December 2005 update. Many providers have used this, as Mr. Nelson testified, as a way to keep people out of institutions. With the implementation of the new provider enrollment and new billing requirements, the option was removed from the provider manual in a February 24th update with no advance notice to providers or consumers. The change was communicated to providers in a letter from the department dated March 3rd with an immediate effective date, and it was left to the providers to notify consumers. Our consumers choose the pooled service option because it provides access to staff around the clock. Over the past 25 years that we have been in business, approximately 60% of our consumers have come from a nursing home, and many of our current consumers believe that they will need to return there if this model goes away. They need night turns, toileting, and repositioning, which would not be available under the typical PCA model. This option also provides greater flexibility, more independence, and the security of knowing that someone is available whenever they're needed. We do realize that there are some issues now with the language that we have initially proposed and will be working with the department to fix that. We are also working with the department separately to try and figure out a way to continue services as well. So timing is critical, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Adams. Members, any questions? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the issue has been laid out well, and I'm very mindful of the time and the fact that there are people here from out of town. If I could indulge just a little bit, though, and have the department come forward, and I hadn't asked before, but I think it would be a little bit helpful, looking at the size of this, just to have a little bit of an understanding of sort of the key underlying assumptions that drive this fiscal note, and whether or not there are opportunities, perhaps in these negotiations, to do something about it. So,
someone from the department, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Vicki Kuhner from the Department of Human Services, and we have a problem here. The department supports group or shared care arrangements for dealing with these individuals, but there are issues of resources with which Shirley York will address, and there are series of issues around documentation and billing, which I will address. Specifically to the documentation and billing, we consider this amendment, this bill, a suspension of current statute. We don't consider it like a delay in implementation because it reflects what has been the requirement in terms of the documentation piece for providing such services. Our statute and rules and our federal requirements specify that there must be daily documentation to individual clients of actual hours provided. And the problems that we've identified by site visits to some of these providers are that we find that they are, as the previous provider described, pooling the hours, billing against what was authorized rather than what was actually provided, and billing as if the care is one-to-one, when in fact it's more of a shared care arrangement, where one person or two people take care of two or three or four individuals. And we do have a shared billing arrangement for such an occurrence, but we wouldn't pay as if it was one-to-one care, and that's the problem, and hence our fiscal note. Our fiscal note, it's hard to identify these clients because they are billing using a one-to-one code, and the residential settings vary quite a bit. Some are foster care, some are other arrangements. But we estimate that just today, about 8 or 9% of our total PCA budget is being handled this way. And if this goes into effect, because the definition of pooling is so vague and variable, it would give freedom to basically double that over the next year, where any group setting could say, well, we're pooling our hours, and so we're not documenting, and we're billing one-to-one, and that is our greatest fear, and hence the calculation. We estimate that in this year, for the remainder of this year, going back to March 1st, would be close to $800,000 loss of a federal match, and next year, $2.6 million, but the disallowance possibly coming in for the federal government to the entire class of congregate setting could be as much as $20 million. We can't, if we are not documenting and that is not required of our providers, we can't draw the federal matching fund. That says, that maybe clarifies that point, but it doesn't solve the problem that has been described to you. That's an issue of resources. So I'll turn it over to Shirley.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Shirley York, and I'm the director of the Disability Services Division, and PCA is one of the services that we are responsible to manage. I would mention that the PCA program actually has been around for quite a long time, and it was set up to support people in their own homes. It's really our desire and our interest to maintain that focus because we feel that there are a number of other ways that we can pay for services in group home arrangements. Under the provisions of the federal and the state law, this is a service that people eligible for Medicaid are entitled to receive, and they are entitled to the full amount that they are authorized to receive under the assessment process. We are obligated also, as Ms. Cooner said, to track the provision of services to each of those individuals under both our federal regulations and our state law. I want to make sure that it's very clear that our policies in regard to this have not changed. I know that there has been some mention of a 1999 bulletin that was in the system, but I also would refresh your memories that the PCA statute was updated in 2001, and we have had a policy and procedure manual online and available to the public about the kind of PCA billings that may occur and how those billings must occur since that time. We are certainly very interested in working with counties and with providers where they feel that there are problems with accommodating this new billing procedure, but I do think it's important to note that we're not changing policy. We're simply changing the way that services are accounted for. And we have offered our assistance to counties and others that if there are problem areas, we would be happy to work with them.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the fiscal notes, it says that sections 4 and 5 are already being documented that way.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for those implementing a shared care arrangement, they are. There's like I think about 240 individuals being billed for in that way, and that doesn't give them as much money as if they could bill one-to-one, but it is more an accurate reflection of how care is being delivered, like a one-to-two or three, or maybe a two-to-four arrangement.
Mr. Thiessen, so there's shared services, there's one-on-one, and then there's this pool, and that's...
There's no... Well...
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is no pooled arrangement under the state law at all. We have no service code for pooled arrangements. There's a shared care, but it's got very specific instructions and conditions. I would also mention, and I know this was brought up by Mr. Nelson before, we honestly are having a lot of trouble tracking the costs of these facilities. And these facilities not only receive the group residential housing, they also receive difficulty of care, and a number of them receive waivered services along with the PCA services. So we have really been concerned about the idea of being able to bill fully for authorized services that are not provided on a one-on-one and not have that coordinated with the other billings.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Cooner, if we are forced to go along with federal law, and what's the fiscal note then if all these facilities decide to get out of business?
Representative Huntley, we haven't calculated that one yet. We don't want that to occur. As I said, group arrangements can be quite appropriate. I think we need to scramble and communicate and figure that out because we do not want to place these clients back in a state hospital. That's exactly what we don't want to happen.
Members, any further questions?
Mr. Chair and members, I think you have a little bit of a touch of how complicated this issue is.
very complicated. On one hand, you could say that if you have three clients being served by a PCA and this taxpayer is paying $45.72 for those three, when it's really only one PCA, and on a one to three, it would be $10.12 per client. I mean, you can kind of do different math and know that at least intuitively it doesn't sound right. However, as you can see, many of these places that picked up some difficult situations use the PCA approach as a way to sort of stay alive. I come before you admitting I think it was important enough to bring the issue. I hope we can work something through here to have a solution that's workable from both sides. We certainly don't want to jeopardize, because there is a bigger risk even yet, if we're out of sync with CMS, even a larger risk that could occur. So I will commit to, but I hope it's helpful, and Mr. Chair, with that, I would ask the Chair to, unless there's any other testimony, to lay it over.
Does anybody else wish to testify here? I see no members. Any further questions? So no questions, the Chair will lay over House File 3557 for possible inclusion of the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Representative Vandeveer.
Before we begin with Representative Vandeveer's, let me tell you, because I'm sensitive to members who are here that are not members of the committee, I'm going to suggest that after Representative Vandeveer's bill, we skip to Representative Howell's bills. We'll do the best we can to try to do those. I hope we can get through those this morning yet. I know there's some testifiers on my House File 2935. I hope we'll still be able to get back to that, but I do think that I want to show respect for the people from Cass County that are here as well. So, Representative Vandeveer, with that, I will move House File 3212. Let's see, does this have some money tied to it? I haven't looked ahead.
Mr. Chair, I believe it would have some.
Okay, so I move it for possible consideration. Representative Vandeveer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I do have the DE1 amendment. If you could move that to get the bill in the shape I'd like it in. Takes about 80 pounds off.
Yeah. Member, I will move the DE1 amendment. I would bring to members' attention that this is another case, not quite as close to the start of our committee, but obviously not matching the 24-hour rule. Perhaps, Representative Vandeveer, you could explain the nature of the amendment so that, because the way I usually handle those exceptions is, in a sense, to seek a consensus, if there's a consensus with the committee, to go ahead and consider it. So perhaps a little bit of an explanation of how it came to be.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Members, this amendment came out of a meeting that we had with the department and some interest groups, and what it does is it substantially lightens the bill up. It takes a lot of the provisions out of it and leaves a couple other ones. It leaves it down to maybe two things. It simplifies it. It does not add anything. It doesn't complicate it, I guess. So from the standpoint of the committee, it makes it easier to and faster to hear.
Any objections to hearing this amendment? Seeing none, we'll vote on the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion to prevail. The DE1 amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I have a one-word oral amendment to the amendment. If someone could move on to line on the amendment, on the DE1 amendment, on page 2, line 6, after prohibit, insert adult.
That's line
2.6. It says a local unit of government may prohibit on the DE1 amendment.
And the words putting the word adult after prohibit?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I'll move to amend House File 3212 as amended by inserting on line 2.6 after the word prohibit the word adult. You understand that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, President.
And
members, this, and Mr. Chair, this bill comes out of some concerns that my constituent have,
regarding group home operations in Scandia Township, and I'll move right into the witnesses. They've been instructed to be quick and to the point. First will be Bob Anderson.
Representative Van Duver, could you give us at least a brief synopsis of what the bill actually does before we hear testifiers?
Certainly. What the bill does as amended is says that it will not be considered a permitted use if a residential program serves an adult who's been convicted of a violent felony within the past 5 years or who is a level 3 sex offender. These are homes in residential neighborhoods. The bill only applies to non-owner occupied residential facilities. It does not apply to foster care, and it only applies to those facilities that serve adults.
Great. Thank you. It's helpful to clarify. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself. Representative Goodman?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I still don't really understand what the bill does.
Representative Goodwin, currently there are no restrictions on group homes licensed by the state in residential neighborhoods as far as the clientele that they can serve, and there's no notification to the public. There just is nothing. And so what this says is that if you're serving the clientele on page 1, line 13 and 14, then you cannot serve that clientele in that setting, in that residential setting.
And if I could add just a little bit to it, as I understand it, we have in law a kind of an override on residential in cities when you have rules about residential areas, what can be there or not. And I think rightfully so, we said that homes and these kind of facilities cannot be overridden. In other words, we don't want cities to say, no, sorry, you can't have any group homes in neighborhoods or you can't have any ICFMRs. What this is doing is to say that's true, except that if you have any residents in that fit these criteria, then you can have an exception, and again, a city, as a matter of fact, in this case, I guess it would not be counted then as a single family. Others is really almost treated like single family.
And Mr. Chair, I should add too that we are also saying that allowing the local unit of government, if they want to prohibit adult residential facilities within 1 mile of any school, licensed childcare center, park, or playground, this excludes, again, any foster care owner-occupied facility.
Go ahead. President Walker, some clarification too?
Just two quick clarifications. One, how would this work with existing individuals that are licensed?
President Vanderbilt?
It's my understanding that they would be grandfathered in and maybe miss age. I think that would be it.
I know the answer.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, this act is effective the day following final enactment, so it only affects homes that come into existence after this act becomes effective.
Representative Walker.
Thank you. Now, but with relicensing and homes having to be relicensed, that would still make them okay, even though that they don't have to come up with relicensing?
I believe the way this is written, it will apply to homes that are going for their first license. It will not. I don't believe the intent is to affect any homes currently in existence, even at the relicensure process.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to have that on record because I'm not sure if I'm getting that from this quick read of this delete all. Second question, since I'm not on public safety, I'm not really familiar with what is considered violent crimes. And so I'd like an idea, besides murder and rape, what else qualifies as a violent crime felony?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Vanderbilt,
Representative Walker, Ms. Hayes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I'd have to look in the statutes and see. That was not defined during the meeting we had, but I can look that up in the statutes.
Now we'll do that as a follow-up. Okay. Let's proceed then with the testimony. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself as you begin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Vandeveer, my name is Bob Anderson. I've lived for nearly 30 years in New Scandia Township in northern Washington County. In recent years, a number of licensed residential program facilities, group homes if you like, have moved into our community. In fact, Scandia now has the highest ratio of licensed feds to inhabitants of any of the 33 communities in Washington County. With these feds have come great concern because of conditions in these group homes and several instances of group home residents threatening or committing crimes against their fellow residents, our community homeowners, and law enforcement. In a moment, we'll outline just one case to illustrate what went wrong. House File 3212 seeks to do three things. First, to balance our state policy between community safety and order and the needs of licensed residential programs. Second, to prevent the most dangerous direct threats to health, safety, and property. And third, to create a safety zone for the most vulnerable in our communities, our children, by banning licensed residences within 1 mile of schools, parks, licensed childcare facilities, and playgrounds. Note, too, that House File 3212 exempts adult owner-occupied group homes. Mr. Chairman, as we hear from my fellow resident Pam Anderson and see the materials she distributes, you'll realize why repeated problems have created cynicism, anger, and frustration in our community. House File 3212 has been written and then amended to be a very narrow, focused proposal to increase respect and protection for licensed program residents while giving local communities some regulatory tools, relief, and peace of mind. This is why we ask for your support of House File 3212. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd like now to ask Pam Anderson to illustrate our challenges with some specific examples.
Well, certainly love it. I would ask, please, in deference to other bills we have, to make that as brief as you can, please. Ms. Anderson?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Pamela Anderson, and I'm also a resident of New Scandia Township. Each of you should have in your possession a summary of 911 emergency calls placed by a group home located in New Scandia Township for the time period designated. As Bob mentioned, I will outline only one individual case in that summary. 6:10:05, 9:53 p.m., Eric Cepeda goes out of control. A 911 call is placed, Chisago County Sheriff's Department responds, but Eric is gone by the time they arrive. Chisago County Sheriff's Department cannot locate Eric. They call for assistance from Washington County Sheriff's Department. The search continues without results. The Minnesota State Patrol is now contacted. A helicopter is requested, but none is available. 6:11:05, 9:30 a.m. Minnesota State Patrol has located Eric. It turns out he has stolen a car and subsequently crashed that vehicle. Eric is picked up by Chisago County and returned to the group home. 6:12:05, 11:15 p.m., Eric has run away again. Eric is discovered approximately 2 hours later attempting to steal another vehicle. Again, Eric is returned to the group home. 6:15, 11:45 p.m., Eric has run away again. He was located and returned to the group home. Of concern is the threat Eric posed to himself, fellow residents and staff, next-door neighbors, and the population at large in this five-day period, and the fact that he was never charged with regard to the stealing and crashing of the vehicle. Of equal concern are the resources used in that time period, 8 Chisago County Sheriff deputies and their vehicle, 2 Washington County Sheriff's deputies and their vehicles, an Osceola Police Department officer, 2 Minnesota State Patrol officers and their vehicles, and untold hours of search and rescue. By asking your support today of House File 3212, we hope to create a much safer environment for group home residents as well as surrounding communities and the individuals who reside there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Do you have any additional testifiers and proponents?
No, Mr. Chair.
Let me invite his other testifiers. Mr. Nelson, I think you wish to testify. Senator Trump, you had a question before. Would you can you wait until we finish the testimony, please?
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Nelson, Executive Director of ARM. I will be very brief with joining me and joining
I believe in support of my commentary is Steve Larson, the Executive Director of the ARC of Minnesota. First off, I want to say I appreciate and sympathize with the frustrations of the good people of New Scandia Township. And based on what I've heard just now and in some discussions yesterday and meeting with those residents and Representative Vanderveer, it sounds like there is a bad situation that has happened out of New Scandia Township, that there has apparently been a breakdown in supervision. There's been a breakdown in reporting, either in the group home, in the county, and maybe in follow-up somewhere along the line. I would disagree with the testifier, Mr. Anderson, that the language is narrow. I believe the language is very broad, and it would affect the 99-plus percent of providers who do an excellent job in assuring the safety not only to the residents, but in the community. And at the same time, I know after many years of not always being on the same side of issues, in fact, often being adversaries as is appropriate with DHS licensing, that they are very vigilant and very tough, and they do an excellent job of dealing with situations like this. But something apparently did break down here in this situation. Therefore, I'd like to suggest that an independent entity, such as the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Mental Retardation, do a review of what exactly happened here and report back you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee and Representative Vanderveer, and get to the bottom of this, because I believe this is a bad situation. Something broke down here, but it is not representative of what goes on across the state of Minnesota in group home after group home after group home.
Thank you. Mr. Rush.
Mr. Chair and representatives, I concur with Mr. Nelson's comments. I think with this bill and the way that it's written, there could be many unintended consequences for persons with disabilities, and that with the breakdown in what's happened in this particular situation, that I highly endorse the solution that Mr. Nelson proposed and actively encourage everyone to work with the county and licensing to look into the situation and seek remedies that will work for everyone, rather than the broad brush solution of legislation that could have many unintended consequences that we can't consider in this particular situation. We need to preserve the right of persons with disabilities to be able to live in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. On a personal level, I'm a little troubled about an isolated incident, which I think the residents probably have every right. It sounds to me like there's something wrong there, and I think, Mr. Nelson, you indicated that. I'm particularly bothered by the 2.6 to 2.8 section, which says, you know, any adult residential facility is restricted. And let me tell you, in my personal experience, and I've had lots of experience all over the state, really, I don't know if it's 99 or if it's 99.9 or whatever it is, of the neighborhoods that have these kind of facilities are delighted to have people with these kind of needs in their neighborhoods. As a matter of fact, when things were happening in Rochester to change the makeup for the Hiawatha home because of our ICFMR rules, it were the neighbors who came to the defense of those, and I find that particular section really, really troublesome. The other, perhaps that's okay, although we may have things already, but I just make that as kind of a starting statement, because I've had so much contact with people in these worlds, and I hope we don't paint the whole world by an isolated incident. Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does this bill fit within the confines of federal law?
Representative Vanderveer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, I think the way it is drafted in the amendment, I think staff indicated there may be a problem with 2.6 to 2.8, but it doesn't apply to any adult facility. It excludes any foster care. But there may be a problem with that. Ms. Aves could comment on that.
Mr. Chair, representatives, there is a great potential that there would be a court challenge.
But, Mr. Chair, I,
Representative Vandiver,
I do understand that a similar provision in, I think, Iowa has made it through their state Supreme Court and some federal courts also, as it dealt with the level three sex offenders. I don't know if it was specifically level three, but so that may be something that could be changing in the near future.
Representative Dayburn?
Mr. Chair, just to help move this thing along, I'd like to make a motion and then suggest a re-referral to public safety after I make my motion. I would move to delete, I guess, section two.
Representative Abler's moved to amend House File 3212 as amended by striking on the DE1 amendment lines 2.6 through 2.8. I think they'll stand alone. I don't know if there'd be any need to do anything in any other sections. Staff, does that work?
Mr. Chair, delete section 2. Delete all of section 2.
Oh, you're right. Okay. Thank you for the advice. So we'll also, I'm assuming you would accept as your amendment, then amendment, then from Representative Abler would be to strike Section 2 of House File 3212 as amended. Discussion. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to speak in favor of this amendment. A couple things come to mind for me. Those that have been on the committee know that actually today's the 23rd, so 2 days ago, my ladybug turned 12. And I had the blessing when she, my cousin's daughter, who calls me Auntie Neve, she was born with Down syndrome 12 years ago, and I took the opportunity to not only take classes, but work in 17 different group homes over a 6-year span. And it was a great learning opportunity, wide variety of spectrums of individuals that have mental health issues and also physical disabilities. One house comes to mind in particular, and this was a house with women. And depending on if there was a change in medication and that trial in between, or someone's parent who made a promise didn't come by, whatever the emotional issues one individual had, she was bipolar, there was different things, and at times they could become very physical and very violent, and there were times that the women would take that out in the neighborhood. But the majority of the time, of the year, of the day, of any given time, they were just regular women who got up and wanted to go to work, have activities and things of that nature. And that was the only one home out of the 17 homes. One of those individuals would have qualified under this bill, and it concerns when you're dealing with individuals that have mental health issues in particular and not understanding what their biochemistry can be doing when a medication has changed and how that can affect not only our hospital situation, in some cases our jail situation, and even going further, there may be some prosecution down the line for an individual. I think we have to be careful without understanding the unknown consequences of, you know, individuals that are just like you and me, just have some challenges that they have every day.
Well, I'm sort of anxious given the time and other people. Well, let me at least give you, Representative Vandiver, it's your bill. You should certainly have a chance to react.
Mr. Chair, from the sounds of concerns of members, I think that I should probably say that that's a good idea.
That's a good one. Even with that, this is to the amendment now that the author is accepted. So, let's complete then. You understand the amendment that Representative Abler offered. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Now, Representative Goodman.
Oh, thank you. A couple questions about the bill before we move it on or whatever we're going to do with it. You know, I'm wondering about a fiscal note, if there's a fiscal impact on this, because if we say that that they can't be in group homes, if they have any of these things, we don't have enough facilities out there. So what's the impact on the jails, the prisons, and the...
Well, I think the intention was to hold over for inclusion. Now, the word that I've gotten is that the primary concern was on that which we just eliminated, because they were worried that we'd have people would have to go to more expensive settings,
right,
if we didn't allow. So that part's been taken care of. I don't know for sure about whether there's some impact. So to be safe about it, notwithstanding maybe other questions, I would intend to hold it over.
For possible inclusion? Mr. Chair? For possible inclusion, Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry, pardon me, Representative Griffin?
For possible inclusion
in the
Health and Human Service bill?
Right.
So it would still say then that it shall not be considered a permitted use if a residential program serves an adult who has been convicted of a violent felony within the past 5 years or who is a level 3 sex offender.
That's a good one, that's correct.
Okay. Then I would like to ask staff if they think this also would be challenged.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I have looked at the Fair Housing Act, the federal law, and I have not gotten any information that leads me to believe that this would be a problem.
Then, Mr. Chair, and if we pass this, where would people go who had been formally convicted of a violent felony and or who is a level 3 sex offender? Would they be then out on the street? Or where would they end up if they couldn't end up in residential program?
I think I have to direct that to the author, Representative Vandeveer. Have you thought about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, the violent felony issue is within the past 5 years. So I would assume then that they would have to be in a different kind of program.
But Mr. Chair, Representative Vandeveer, what different kind of program would they have to be in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, not in my constituent's backyard with children running all over.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Vandeveer, I don't think you're going to be able to avoid that. Only trouble is they'll be more desperate if they have no place to live. So they'll still be in the neighborhoods or they'll still be on the street or whatever. So where are they going to be, Representative Andrew? We're doing the kind of same thing we did when we emptied the state hospitals here, is not providing other services and ended up shifting instead people with mental illness to the prison system. So if they're not going to end up in some of these places, if they need them, if they can't be living out on their own, then where are they going to go?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, keep in mind that these are commercial, non-owner occupied facilities that are going to not have one or two. They are going to have, I think, 4 to 6. Could potentially have 6 of the same type of clientele. So I think at some point there needs to be a balance between, these type of facilities, which generally I support and I think people in Scandia support, and the idea that currently the residents have no knowledge, there's no reporting requirement, there is no restrictions at all, and maybe you have some suggestion that would be better, and we're certainly open to it, but when you have cars being stolen, crashed into other cars, all these reports, police reports that are outlined here, and you have the idea that absolutely anybody could be admitted to those homes, and the people have no right or recourse or way to know that they're even there.
Well, no.
That's a good one.
Chair, I certainly do, and Representative Vandeveer, understand the concerns of the neighborhood in this case, but I would like an accompanying police report to talk about what other domestic violence issues and cars were stolen and so forth, that some people that didn't come out of the residential treatment center. So I don't think you're going to avoid those problems in any neighborhood. If you figure that plan out, let me know. But I do think that what you're going to end up doing is just putting people on the street, creating more problems, and obviously have no alternative to what your bill is for a solution for these. And I think that this is like taking a hammer to to something that doesn't need that much of a confining solution. I think what you need to do probably is take a real look at what kind of rules and the group homes have and how they are dealing with their residents and how well staffed they are and that type of thing. But to just say dump them out on the street is not going to help anybody.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I won't belabor this any longer than other than in response to your questions, but your idea that there should be absolutely no restrictions at all on who's in the group homes, yeah, it is a commercial activity, it's non-owner occupied, it's a number of people in the facility in the middle of a residential neighborhood, and the local unit of government has no information, no reporting, no records, and no ability at all to say anything at all about who's in there. And that's the issue. And if you think that's okay, then I guess we just disagree.
Well, I think that the point that's being made, that there is some validity to what Vandeveer is, that a private home, why are we treating this significantly different than a private home, which we have the same kinds of liabilities? I think, Representative Goodwin, that's the point that you're trying to make. And we may differ on that, but I understand that, and frankly, I have some sympathy for that as well. Members, I'm inclined to suggest, because I do want to allow time, that we do have people here, that we lay this over. I think Representative Vandeveer has gotten a sense of the feelings in the committee and can see if there's any continued discussion. But I think you can see that there may be some issues that would need to be worked on for consideration, Representative Vandeveer.
Mr. Chair, if I could make one last comment, I think the suggestion of the omnibus study of just Scandia, the situation in Scandia to see what went wrong as we're... Everyone's in agreement there that the system isn't functioning the way it should be. In that particular instance, I feel that maybe at minimum, I hope the committee would direct a statewide study or incident report similar to the one that's been provided by the people of Scandia to the committee members, because I wonder if we really know the extent of these problems, and maybe this isn't the solution, but possibly some reporting, maybe better monitoring. Clearly something is needed, but I'm not convinced that we have a grasp of the problem and of the issues, and we are talking about expanding these. The governor has got additional money to promote more of them, and I think it's an issue that needs to be looked at. So.
Fair enough. Chair, layover House File 3212 as amended. Representative Howells, I apologize. You understand the process. We'll do the best we can here, and I respect the fact you probably have some people from out of town here. I believe we're beginning, first of all, with 34. Numbers right here. This would be, 2574 is the first rule that you would have considered. Okay. I'll move House File 2574 for, let's just move it at this point, and then we'll figure out all the rest of the mechanics so you can get started.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chairman House. I have with me the Cass County Board Chairman, Jim Demjian, and the Cass County Administrator, Robert Yoakum. I'm going to let them say something for 60 seconds or less apiece. It is a hospital moratorium construction bill of 25 beds or less. I think we all know what that is and what it does, and they can give a brief statement as to how it came about, and then we can go from there, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Representative House. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Jim Demjian, Cass County Board Chair, and I'm happy to be here to present our case. As you know, or maybe not know, Cass County is the fifth largest county in the state and one of seven counties in the state of Minnesota without a hospital. The distance to a hospital a lot of times is 70 to 100 miles with windy rural type of roads. The planning process in Cass County has taken over 33 different motions by the county board over the last 4, 5, 6 years to get it off the ground. We have resolutions of support from towns, cities, and one of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. We have the counties of Beltrami, Cass, Crow Wing, and Itasca backing our process, and we've also had the Benedictines out of Duluth volunteering to help us with this process. I also have with me today is Bob Yoakum, our county administrator, so I'll turn it over to him at this time.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Bob Yoakum, Cass County Administrator. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we want to assure you that we have coordinated our local planning process in addition to the governmental agencies identified with area existing hospital providers. We have also, in accordance with Minnesota Statute 144, initiated the public interest review process presently required by statute. The Minnesota Department of Health has done a preliminary review of our application, which they have indicated is appropriately complete at this point. The public comment process has been initiated by the Minnesota Department of Health with comments requested by April 5th. So the comment period that the Minnesota Department of Health has asked for is coming up very soon. The last element, Mr. Chairman, is we want to assure you and the committee that we have coordinated our local planning with the Minnesota State Departments of Administration with respect to the site, the Minnesota Department of Human Services, who are the have custodial control at Ogwaching, and the Department of Natural Resources, that our project includes an aquatic management area involving the shoreline at Ogwaching. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for your incredible management of time. We had to say aye just because of that.
One clarification, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Newhouse.
I didn't mention that the bill says, and I'm sure we'll get the question, that the hospital would be within a 20-mile radius of the Ogwaching facility. The reason we did that, there's a federal rule about dealing with critical access hospitals that Congressman Oberstar is working with us on. We think we can remedy that rule. We're only a mile and a half too close to another hospital. If not, we need to slide the hospital down the highway a mile and a half.
Well, I support this, but I do want to make a very important comment, and I've had conversation with Representative Halls. I'm not saying this to slow down the process, but members will recall the work that we did with the Maple Grove Hospital, and you will also recall some what I think are unfortunate criticisms somehow about we didn't follow the process. Well, this committee did follow the process right to the letter, and people may disagree with our conclusion, but we certainly did follow it, and I want to be consistent. I mean, there is a reason for the public interest process and advisory process. The timing is a little more difficult. I think the conclusion that we reached is that we can move this bill for recommend to pass and move it to the general register with a clear understanding, however, that we would ask that it stay there until we do get conclusion. I'm understanding that the health department is going to expedite that, and we should see that by mid to latter part of April. I'm not doing that all to slow up. I mean, I will love the day when we don't have to say Ogwaching again. And I'm really happy to see that the area has stepped up to the plate and that we can see the transformation be successful. So I wish you the best in your project, and I just wanted to acknowledge that. Representative Pepin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hose, as you know, we just passed a bill to build a Maple Grove Hospital. And I know that last year you had some concerns on it, and your suggestion and your vote was to send the bill to the Department of Health to make sure that there were proper criteria so that our community could be served in the best way possible. And I'm wondering, I'm curious as to why you didn't have legislation that would send this to the Department of Health, since that seemed to be your preference, so that you can make sure that this hospital does serve the needs of your community as seen by the Department of Health.
Representative Hall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, your memory is just slightly off. What I said was allow the city of Maple Grove to make a choice. Give it to them. Let's not let the legislature decide who builds a hospital, My county sent out an RFP to six different entities surrounding the area, and only one offered to build a hospital without state money. That's what they accepted. But we are going through the public review, which is something you don't technically have to do, but should be done.
President Pepin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Powers, maybe my memory is wrong, but I recall that the legislation that you actually supported would have sent the bill back to the Department of Health with criteria. Is that not your memory?
Representative Powers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, that was probably part of that whole, I believe it was an amendment. But my whole process was that with that, my whole objection was, let the city of Maple Grove decide. Don't ask us to decide or pick who builds a hospital. That was my objection.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howes, the amendment actually did not say anything about the city of Maple Grove. It said the Department of Health, and it had certain criteria, including mental health beds, including number of trauma beds, OBGYN. It didn't have anything to do with the city of Maple Grove, and that's fine. I just, it's good for you to change your mind. I just was curious.
Representative Hundley.
Well, Mr. Chair, does the Department of Health is going to have a public hearings on this and take testimony?
Mr. Hundley, that's what that's been initiated, and that's what this public interest report would be about.
Does that mean that the Department of Health has a position on this bill currently, or are they holding back on that?
Well, I guess if there was someone here they could speak to. My understanding is that the Department of Health is neutral. They've just been called upon to give that public interest, and that's advisory only in the respect of is there a need for a hospital, not necessarily whether this is the right solution or not. But is there someone here that could acknowledge that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, my name is Julie Sonier, and I direct the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health, which is the unit of the department that is responsible for performing the public interest reviews. The department does not have a position on this bill. We do currently have a public interest review that is underway in accordance with the submission that we received from Cass County.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you for the department, Mr. Chairman. But my memory is the same as Representative Pepin's, and my concern was why isn't the department doing a study on this particular proposal?
I'm sorry, I forgot.
Ms. Sonier.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the department is currently conducting a public interest review. We haven't taken a position on this bill because we have no authority to compel entities to have completed the public interest review before presenting a bill for consideration by the legislature.
Mr. Chairman?
And Representative Emmer, in that regard, if you read the statutes which calls for this public interest, it could be construed as a little bit of vague about timing. My personal position is it doesn't make any sense for it to even be there unless it really is advisory in making a decision. So that's why I've asked, and the office agreed that the final conclusion coming out of, and by the way, at that point, depending upon what that content says, I would reserve judgment as to whether we need to actually hold another hearing or whether it's goal or what it may be. But my own feeling is the sequence should be we hear that before this legislature can conclude.
Then maybe my memory is failing like Representative Pepin's, but I came here late in the process on the last hospital, and there was apparently the legislature, rather than following this process, requested a study on that proposal?
No, Representative Emmer, in the case of well, we did exactly the same thing. The timing was such that we had the results. The health department stood before this committee and gave us the results of a public interest study before then we heard, obviously in that case, competing presentations.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion while formalize a bit more of that. House File 2574, we didn't amend it. That House File 2574 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. You all understand that motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We are beginning to infringe, but do you think we can find a really quick way to finish the next bill as well, Representative House?
Mr. Chairman, if you would move the bill, and then there is an amendment that wonderful Randall Chun has spent many hours getting the exact words, and we're set.
I'll move House File 3486, and I believe this one probably does have to be held over for possible inclusion because we're probably a fiscal note.
Correct?
Okay. Let's see. And you said there's an amendment. I'll move the DE3 amendment, which is a delete all amendment. And this will get the bill in the shape that the author chooses. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative House, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there's at least two places in statute where we have transferred up to 150 beds, nursing home beds that the state owned to Cass County, to a chosen operator of Cass County. We're doing this again because evidently there is a specific process that you go through with DHS to do this. We've talked to DHS. They are in total support of what we are doing. We've decreased it to 80 beds, so the fiscal note that you do have now is probably incorrect. And also this language is in the department's bill. So, and I believe if Mr. Chung could comment, the language that I have here before you is the same as the department's bill, and we just wanted to make sure that this goes along with the hospital because they are truly both tied together, and the nursing home facility, the long-term care facility, actually would be built first.
I'm sorry, I was distracted from Mr. Chung.
Mr. Chair and members, just to clarify, the new language being added is very similar to the language in the governor's bill, but some modifications were made. The last sentence is a little bit different, and I think this also specifies it's located on the grounds of the Agua Ching campus, but it's very similar to that language.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we did work with DHS in doing this language, although it might be slightly different than the department's language, if there's somebody here, I know they do support it.
Yeah. My understanding in discussing with the department is that, one, even with that increase, that the rate is within kind of the reasonable ballpark of nursing homes in the region, and two, that the 80 beds, given the kind of the region and so forth, is reasonable from the needs of the area. It's a little tricky because the Agua Ching beds aren't exactly the same use as these beds will be, but that the department's satisfied. Is that a fair summary, Representative House?
Mr. Chairman, that would be very fair.
Okay. The fiscal note actually shows no expense in this biennium, and the expense then is the next biennium. I read that correctly, Representative House?
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct, but that would be also based on 150 beds, and we're now 80, so...
Okay, we haven't probably gotten up to date. We'll pick up that later.
Yeah.
Any further discussions from members? And I know we have testifiers here. Any questions from members?
Okay.
Representative Hummel?
Chair, this authority rests with the Department of Human Services, not the Department of Health, for the transfer of the beds.
And I think when we get these questions on beds, it's been the Department of Human Services that gives us the advice, yes. So no further discussion. All those in favor of House File 3486 as amended, I'm sorry, the chair will hold over for possible inclusion, House File 3486 as amended.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, members.
We are going to be in recess. What was the time for class? We're working on rooms and places and so forth, so if you'll listen to the session, we'll announce, but we will recess and then come back later. And my apologies to, I see Representative Nornes, but I think we're pushing too much on the time to try to do another one. So, is Representative Nornes here?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what do we have? Do we have another committee at 12:30 in here? You know what, Representative Nornes? I don't know. Do you have a sense? Is yours can you do something in a couple of minutes, or does this need more time? Do you want to come back later? I know you probably have people here. Wait? Okay, then we'll wait till later. With that, we're in recess.
Let's call this cozy little meeting of the Health Policy and Finance Committee to order. All right, I think what we're going to try to do, I've got a bill up in commerce, and then I've got a bill up in civil law as well, so I have to figure out for myself how to do it. But I think, Representative Nornes, you have some people here, so I'd like to do yours first. Representative Pepin, do you have any out-of-town people, or you need to get to commerce, I suppose, too, don't you?
Yeah.
Me too. You need our vote?
I don't know. Do we need their votes? What do you think, Tom? Well, let me put it this way. I've been around long enough as a chair. If I need your votes, I know how to recess and do that kind of thing. So.
Aye.
I guess, let's do Buds, and then we'll decide. Senator Nornes? I move House File 2854 be recommended pass, and I believe this probably has a fiscal note attached to it.
It does not.
No, it's not?
I mean,
okay.
You should have a fiscal note that shows it has no fiscal
note. Okay,
impact.
All right, I apologize. And then I guess the motion would be it doesn't need to see any other committees then, right?
No.
So it would be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Representative Nornes.
I should add, Mr. Chair, that my committee meets in a room just exactly this size, so... It's compact. Appreciate the committee's time, and we'll make this as brief as we can. It's for Lake Region Hospital, which is located in Fergus Falls. They are planning to make a few changes, taking a few of the retiring the nursing home beds, and doing some expansion, small expansion of the rehab center. Representing Lake Region Healthcare Corporation is Cap Matson, and I think I'd like to have him present the picture to you.
Sure. Welcome. If you'd introduce yourself again for the record.
My name is Kent Matson. I'm General Counsel for Lake Region Healthcare Corporation. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your opportunity to be here today. We've presented the committee with a fairly straightforward request. Lake Region Healthcare Corporation is presently operating 121 beds in Fergus Falls. We are the only full-level hospital within Otter Tail County. The plan of the hospital is to retire 13 nursing home beds, and what that does is provides the facility with the opportunity to expand their rehabilitation department by two beds. So the goal is to go from 121 down to 110 through the subtraction of 13 and the addition of two rehab unit beds. What's important, I think, to remember is that the type of care provided in the acute inpatient rehabilitation beds at Lake Region, you can't duplicate that level of care unless you travel 2 hours to St. Cloud or 3 hours to Bemidji. So this type of service is very unique in the Fergus Falls area, and we think that allowing the additional beds would provide betterment to the community.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify regarding this bill? Representative Huntley and I have visited about this. It is my judgment, I think supported by Representative Huntley, that a two-bed increase in an area like this is really doesn't raise to the standard of the needs assessment in the health department. I see the health department is affirmatively shaking heads, yes, for the record.
It's not quite Maple Grove, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I thought so. So, in the judgment of this committee, I think we can act on this without going through a separate process. I think things have been made. Are there any questions from members?
Mr. Chair, I was not lobbied by any lobbyist on this.
Wasn't that a pleasure?
I don't understand it.
Would you like to be?
Is this a consent item?
Well, Representative Norris, I think in fairness, I think I would send it to the regular General Register. It's complicated enough, and other people who've had things, so you have the opportunity if there are questions, and I would support you on the floor as well, but I think it would be our best interest to be General Register. That's a fair question. Being no further questions, I'll renew my motion that House File 2854 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Well,
and I apologize. I apologize for the delay for you from this morning.
Oh, no problem.
Representative Pepin, would you like to do yours?
That'd be fabulous.
Go ahead and do yours. Representative Pepin, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I would move my bill, let my bill pass, and go to be included for consideration in the omnibus bill.
Representative Pepin moves House File 3615 be recommended to pass, and that be recommended for inclusion in the House, the Health Policy and Finance Omnibus Bill. Representative Pepin, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. People Incorporated has provided community support to adults with mental illness in both Hennepin and Ramsey County for a number of years, and this is a bill brought to me by them. It's pretty simple. It basically has three components. It establishes two Safe Haven pilot programs, one in Ramsey and one in Hennepin County. These pilot programs will operate two 10-bed facilities for folks who have been homeless for at least a year. The second aspect, it provides for a supplementary rate in addition to current rate not to exceed $700 per month. And number three, it provides that an individual remain eligible for group residential housing and the supplementary rate when transitioning into individual living. I do have two folks from People Incorporated who wanted to say just a few words,
sure,
Joan White and Patrick Wood.
Okay, welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself as you begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Patrick Wood. I'm the homeless policy advocate for People Incorporated. Up until 2 weeks ago, I was the street outreach worker and coordinator of the homeless outreach project for People Incorporated for 11 years. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the folks that we're serving. Every night, about 800 people sleep outside in Hennepin and Ramsey County. And many of these folks, more than half, are struggling with undiagnosed and untreated mental health and chemical dependency issues. These are folks who are unable to tolerate, thank you, who are unable to tolerate stimulation of crowded settings in shelters. They experience difficulty managing their symptoms, they're disruptive to other shelter guests, or they have difficulty following shelter rules. Frequently, the only clinically significant relationship, trusting relationship that these folks have is with the street outreach worker. Now, in our experience, even if this worker is able to help the individual reach the starting line in terms of diagnosis, initial treatment, benefits and some sort of housing, often the individual will fail in housing because they lose the significant relationship that they have with the outreach worker. This bill would create the opportunity to establish a continuum of services that are consistent as the person moves through various stages of treatment, housing, and recovery, in part because it allows that outreach worker to maintain the relationship with the individual. We all value consistent, healthy relationships in our lives, and it's no less true for people who have experienced years of homelessness, illness, and disenfranchisement. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome, and if you'd also begin the same way, introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Joan White, and I'm with People Incorporated. I am their program development person, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here to talk a little bit about who this bill is intended to serve. In Minnesota, we've heard a lot about ending long-term homelessness, and this legislative body has appropriated a great deal of money for housing support. And that is going to be very, very well received in the communities in Minnesota where it's going to go. The population, and one of the things that's being passed around are some pictures that come from our work in the camps. The pictures that are being passed around are actual pictures of folks that we serve who live, of their camps, of people we serve who sleep outdoors. The clients that we serve do not sleep in shelters. They are the unsheltered homeless adults. And what I wanted to say about this bill that's before you is that this bill targets the absolute bottom layer of homelessness in Minnesota. It is not intended for people who are able to work with or communicate with people, shelter providers and other people in shelters. It's targeted towards people who sleep alone outside, who have untreated mental illness, out of control chemical dependency, and unrecognized traumatic brain injury. The facilities that we are talking about are not a typical transitional housing program. They're an incredibly staffed, small facilities with University of Minnesota, Department of Psychiatry doctors, with a registered nurse, and with 24-hour trained staff in working with people who have multiple years of long-term homelessness, mental illness, chemical dependency, and other disabilities. Thank you.
Ms. Wood, are you familiar with the fiscal note that that we've gotten? What I'm wondering about is the rationale for the GRH supplementary of 700. What your base that you're getting now, and how much this has increased, and how you come up with the 700.
The $700 was put forward by Senator Bergman when she initially drafted the bill. It's to reflect the higher cost of care for people who have been living outside. It isn't a matter of a transitional housing program where people just are available. We're sometimes the only level of services for them, the only ones they trust. They meet these outreach workers in the streets and in the camps, and they come into these facilities and they're attached to that outreach worker. But they're not going to go down to the emergency room to see somebody. They're not going to keep an appointment. Our docs are in the house in jeans and t-shirts, meeting with these folks and starting them on medications as soon as they will agree to try.
And what is it that you actually pay for with the $700 supplement?
It will pay for the staffing, the doc and the nurse. That it's supportive services. And when they move into the community, when they move from that one of those 10-bed facilities, then moving into an independent living situation that we've developed with a landlord, and they will maintain their supportive services. They'll still be seeing those docs and nurses. They'll still have our outreach workers, and they'll still have staff from our homeless program that serves them. And that'll stay with them when people start to get a little foothold, and they start to have some successes, and they get more willing to trust traditional providers. We start connecting them with employment programs and with other kinds of programs so that we can, over the course of anywhere from a year to 2 years, we can start to drop away and they can start to rejoin utilizing traditional services in the metro area.
Without the supplemental 700, what would you be getting then? You'd be getting just a standard GRH rate?
We'd be getting a standard GRH, which would end at the point that they were just starting to trust enough to move into their own apartment. It would end after they left that facility. They would not have the income to rent an apartment.
And maybe one final for me anyway. Some of the services sounds like they might be eligible through other programs. I mean, you mentioned the medical and that kind of thing. What about the other mental health services, medical assistance, whatever other possibilities? Are those just not applicable in this case?
They're applicable if we could qualify the folks that we serve who are sleeping outside for medical assistance. About less than 20% of the folks that we serve have any kind of medical assistance or general assistance medical care. As we move through the process and we get them to agree to sign paperwork, which is difficult for some, they fear that if they sign paperwork for the government, that means the government has control of them. It's very mixed up with their thought disorders. These folks have serious mental illness. So sometimes it's well over years or more before they're even willing to go with us to a building to start applying.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Huntley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, there is a positive or a cost on this fiscal note, but you know, we all like to believe that every program is going to save us money in the long run, and this one probably will. There's a number of studies that we think that homeless people don't cost us anything. They cost us $40,000 to $50,000 a year already, just having them on the streets in terms of medical services and social services. And these programs actually reduce the cost when they work. And this is really a pretty small pilot project. So I agree with the department's got to put a fiscal note, but I think overall we're going to save money with it.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Paul.
Yeah, thank you. As most of you know, I've worked with this same population for about 25 years in my job. I've been in the camps in these pictures that you're passing around. This is a very, very difficult group to get to gain trust with. And I will tell you, I've met with People Incorporated and Miss White a couple times, and they have, as far as my experience has been, the best understanding of this population of anybody I've met with. They've got a great deal of credibility with me for what that's worth. I think that they deserve a chance to be able to continue on and help this group.
Well, it looks like you've built a good reputation across the room.
Mr. Speaker, I just wanted to point out one thing that these two fine folks haven't pointed out. They actually, in 2005, People Incorporated actually had a campaign in which they raised $1 million from private funds. So this isn't just them coming to, you know, the government to have them fix everything. They've also put in a great deal of effort to get private funds from this as well.
Are there any insights from the department on this that we should hear? Is anybody here? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify? I'm assuming that was concluding remarks, so you're ready to roll. Representative Samuelson.
Just a quickie. You'll be able to serve 20 people. Will that be through the whole year, or will you be serving more people than that during the course of the year? And then how many people are there that fall into this category in the metro area, or say how many apples that you'll be serving?
We should be able to serve about 20 people at a time, hopefully up to 40 people annually. As people move along, we move more people back in behind them. In terms of the total number of people who sleep outside every night, it's 800. Of those, I'm going to ask Patrick how many of them what percentage of those he would say would really need this level of intervention.
Of the 800 folks who stay outside every night, probably two-thirds. The Wilder survey for 2003 indicated that about 47% of the respondents indicated that they had been told they had a serious and persistent mental illness, and that doesn't reflect the population that lives outside. Those are folks who frequently don't respond to the survey, and they have a higher rate of mental health and chemical dependency issues.
Mr. Sanderson?
Thank you. I really support your project and your program. You know, whatever we can do to make it work, I think that's important.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, and you're one of the witnesses there. What percentage of these folks are veterans?
Senator Huntley, members of the committee, roughly 30% of the men are veterans. Overall, 16% of people who are homeless. But if you just look at the men, it's 1 out of 3. And that's consistent with figures nationwide.
Well, thanks for your testimony, and thanks for what you do. With that, Representative Pippin renews her motion at House File 3615, and the chair will rule that it will be held over for possible inclusion in our finance bill.
Representative Bradley.
Oops. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 2935 be held. Yes, since it's kind of some finance stuff at this point anyway, I would say that be held for a conclusion in our finance bill.
Representative Bradley, have you talked to the tax chair at all? Does this need to go to taxes?
Oops, I'm sorry. This has got to go to taxes, doesn't it? Yep.
I'll move that House File 2935 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Taxes.
Representative Bradley moves the House File 2935 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Bradley, to your bill.
It's apparent again that without Ms. Drew, I would be in huge trouble. Mr. Chair and members, this is kind of an outcome on a personal level. I recall the times when we've temporarily reduced the Minnesota Care Provider Tax, and we always had provisions in language for it to pop back up again. And it struck me that we have no provisions when it's appropriate to go the other way. That is, for it to be incrementally reduced if there's a sufficient reserve or surplus in order to be able to justify that. So that's all this really does, is provide, at least in legislative language, something that would allow for a contingent reduction. And let me explain something, because there's sort of a puzzle with healthcare costs increasing. One can certainly understand why the revenues flowing into the healthcare access fund increase fairly rapidly. If healthcare costs are increasing 10-15% a year, that means that the rate of it going into, when you're taking 2% of that, is going to increase pretty rapidly. On the other side of the formula is something that I think we get reminded of often. I think Representative Aber often reminds it of it, us of it, and that is that the what we pay out in Minnesota Care is pretty well fixed. I mean, it's almost artificially fixed, and in some respects, providers would often argue that sometimes it's even below their costs. So if you understand anything about economics, what you have is a rapidly growing revenue income and a somewhat flat, at least relative compared to the private marketplace, expenses. And that means that we typically see surpluses. It seems to me that to the extent we have the ability to do it, that those surpluses ought to help us reduce the expense of the provider tax. And that's what this would provide for. It's contingent. It only happens if the commissioner can do an outlook that indicates it's justified. It's temporary to the point of when it's used. It doesn't stop the legislature from doing anything. It just simply says that you have the opportunity. Now, obviously, if you know that I'm carrying a MCHA bill that uses the money, this is kind of the other side of it. And I make no apologies for doing those, because you never know what's actually going to happen around here. And it seems to me that it's fair to keep these things in the mix. It's time for questions.
Thank you, Representative Bradley. Any questions? Any testifiers that wish to testify for or against this?
I know there were some people before when we were meeting that had to leave, so I'm sure there might be.
Since this is the chairman's bill, I'm sure this is testimony in favor of this.
I never count on anything.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Phil Rivenis, and it's a great pleasure to find a bill that we can agree on, and we've found some others in the past as well. But I think I represent the Minnesota Medical Group Management Association, which is a professional association of about 800 or 900 members across the state who run clinics and group practices. And we've strongly felt that there ought to be kind of a blinking feature to the provider tax. The tax, you may know, was 1.5% before January 1st of 2004, and that reduction to 1.5% was sunsetted in law and automatically changed without the intervention of the legislature. It's our calculation, and perhaps yours as well, that 1.5% is plenty enough to pay for the expenditure needs of Minnesota Care and a few other things that have been funded out of that fund. But because it went to 2%, it created a huge surplus, and $425 million from that fund was used for the balancing of the budget during the tough fiscal years. And we kind of understand that. I've served in both the House and the Senate, and I know that in tough times you look around for wherever money might exist. But I think we've always felt that the provider tax should be limited to paying for Minnesota Care. The provider community has never been wild about this tax. We felt that there should be some general tax that supported this cause. But so long as it's the provider tax, it should really be pretty exclusive for that purpose. This gives an opportunity for that adjustment downward during times of surplus. And so we applaud Representative Bradley for bringing this bill forward, and we strongly support it.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Well, first of all, let's see. Is there any others in the audience that wish to testify for or against? All right. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, just one of the people that was going to testify was Dr. Luer, who is the head of the MMA and from city of Torquay, which is close to my area. And in addition to that, we'll say that there were two other people in Duluth who testified in another bill this morning, so Highway 35 got used.
And it was going to be positive testimony, correct?
Yeah, it definitely was going to be positive.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I know that there was somebody from the dental community also that had wished to testify in favor of it as well, but wasn't able to stay around this afternoon.
All right. Any further questions, members? Seeing no further questions, Representative Bradley will renew his motion that House File 2935 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion passes. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Abler, welcome to your committee. Would you like to make a motion?
Yeah, I'd like to move House File 2807 be recommended to pass, and this might be mild enough to be a consent thing, but it's very mild, so at least it goes to the floor. Whichever way.
Is there a page here?
Yes, it's Ben.
Oh, yeah. So the committee can decide that, Mr. Chair.
All right, well, why don't we listen to the bill and then we can get the advice from the committee.
I'm sorry, I'm an oral amendment.
Abler moves,
previous chair.
Abler moves that House File 2807 be recommended to pass and then we'll decide about its course. What amendments do you have?
I don't have any.
Oh. With
an oral one, perhaps. A real simple one. What's that?
You did.
I marked your calendar.
505.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have done a lot of clamping down, and in many cases, well done, about the disclosure of people who have committed various crimes. This morning we talked about level 3 sex offenders and violent felons. We've done all kinds of things with disqualifications and set-asides in our licensing area, and sometimes the net becomes a little bit too tight, and we pick up a fish we really didn't mean to catch. This bill is about that. I could have had the person affected by this come down, but they're actually busy working in their daycare, and so I said, don't come down. We'll just take care of ourselves. This letter from child care providers mentions a few things. But the short version of all this is there was a young girl who was 13 years old, and she stole something from a grocery store. She shouldn't have done that, and they caught her and went through all the local things. She's never charged. She made it up to the grocery store, and all was forgotten until her mother applied. In the latest turn of events, had to get her child care license renewed. And somehow this wound up in the records, and they have to post now at this child care that there's a juvenile misdemeanor person there, and which is a little beyond what I think we intended to do. And so this bill would exempt from posting the requirement of people. And Mr. Kerber can give more detail about the specifics, how they handle it, but it would eventually make this a non-postable offense. And that's really the heart of the bill. And the department has not brought this forward. This is forward from me and my constituent, but I've worked with Mr. Kerber, who maybe can come and offer a few thoughts if he would like. Well, the department officially has one. I've been working with this. Is that enough time? So it didn't come from the department?
Kerber, welcome to the committee. If you have testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services, where I'm the Director of the Licensing Division. And I need to say first that this is sort of contrary to the Governor's initiative last year that made a number of changes to the background study law. But what it does is provide a very narrow exception to that notification requirement that Representative Abler described. Under some of the changes that were adopted last year, under the heading, really, a good heading, that parents of kids in child care ought to have as much information as possible about their providers, there was a new requirement adopted that said that anytime somebody is working in a child care setting under a set-aside of a disqualification or under a variance that's been granted, the license holder is required to provide a written notification to the parents of that so that the parents can make the decision. What this does is it makes a very narrow exclusion from that requirement for a minor child living in the home of a family child care provider where the set-aside is is granted for a disqualification for misdemeanor theft. So it's family child care only, a minor child of the license holder living in the home, misdemeanor theft disqualification. So it's really quite narrow.
And Mr. Gerber, do you have a position on this?
I'm not really aware. I think that the official position of the department is that we continue to support the governor's initiative last year that kind of provided additional information for consumers of child care services.
You read right out of the book very well there. I got that. Representative Abler, I don't know. I mean, I've become very sensitive because I still got to go to civil law yet today with a bill. You talk about not being public data with some qualifier. I don't know. They might because of that. Is there anybody? I don't know anybody here that serves on civil law. I don't think so. Is that? I know. I never know how to judge it. I know that it's a little problem getting on calendars and everything like that if we don't judge it right. We could. Let's see. No, this is our last bill, isn't it? Shoot. I don't know. Representative Abel, you've been around too. Any thoughts?
The floor is the Senate. If they want it, they'll call it.
Call back. That's fine.
I understand.
Good luck. All I can say is good luck. All right. Any further testimony from anyone? Any questions from members? Representative Huntley.
I sometimes think that we go a little too far in trying to punish people with minor things wrong, and there's probably nobody in this room that hasn't done something that, if they had been caught, might have showed up on this list. So I think this is a pretty decent approach.
I do too. I would suspect, however, Representative Abler, that it probably should go to the General Register. It's a sensitive area, even though it makes a lot of sense. It takes a while to explain that, and in that regard, probably is safer if it goes to the General Register. There's no further discussion. Representative Abler renews his motion that House File 2807 without amendment be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register.
Without amendment? Oh. Okay.
I'm sorry, I couldn't. Everyone understand that motion? Everyone in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman.
We are on at 9:30 and we're going to be in room 5 tomorrow. That? Turn.